Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Trevor Burrus.
And I'm Aaron Powell.
Joining us today is Radley Balko, who reports on criminal justice, the drug war, and civil liberties for the Washington Post. He was previously a senior editor at Reason and also previously at the Cato Institute. His book with Tucker Carrington, The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, was the subject of a previous Free Thoughts episode. Today we're discussing the new edition of his book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Welcome back to the show, Radley.
Thanks for having me.
When did you get interested in the militarization of police? Because it's interesting that everyone now seems to kind of realize this, especially post-Ferguson, but in a weird way, it also creeped up on us.
Yeah, I think I first kind of started paying attention to it in a, you know, as part of my beat when I was at the Cato Institute, because I was covering the drug war. And obviously, the drug war was a big motivating factor in the trend toward police militarization. And it, specifically, I had been reporting or covering a couple of no-knock raids that had been done to serve drug warrants. And after looking into a few of those cases, I started tracking them pretty closely and seeing that they were not only were the raids themselves very common and for kind of low-level offenses, the number of times police were making mistakes because the drug war is fought with dirty information sort of by necessity. So innocent people were getting victimized in these raids, as well as, you know, people who were at worst guilty of kind of low-level consensual drug offenses. At the time, that was probably like in the early 2000s, at the Cato in 1997 and published a white paper about sort of creeping police militarization, started looking into the work of Peter Kraska, a criminologist in Kentucky who had documented kind of the rise of SWAT teams across the country. And I guess just from there, it was, you know, you saw some of the sort of excesses of policing, some of the problems of policing culture, but then, and some of the kind of, and the problems with holding rogue police officers accountable, but at the same time, kind of the level of accepted force as a matter of policy in police departments across the country was increasing as well. So you had sort of problems with bad cops going out there, you know, violating policies, violating the law even. You had problems with holding those cops accountable. You had problems with police culture. But then just kind of even within all of that, you had just as a matter of policy, the amount of force that police were permitted to use for increasingly low-level crimes, you know, that ratio was getting out of whack as well. And I think the first paper I wrote for Cato on this came out in, I want to say, 2006. But even before that, I mean, if you go back to the 1990s, you know, when I was in high school and college, it was the right that was up in arms about police militarization, particularly with the ATF raids on people suspected of violating various gun laws. And then, you know, we had people like G. Gordon Liddy on a show telling his listeners to shoot for the head when ATF agents come into your house. And you had, you know, the NRA calling federal police officers jackbooted thugs. You had Waco and Ruby Ridge. So, you know, I think there's this just this been this continual trend for a long time, but it was also sort of fascinating to watch as various parts of the American political establishment get upset about this when it affects their own people, but don't seem to be nearly as concerned when it affects people with whom they disagree politically.
How new is this trend as opposed to us noticing it, paying attention to it, or the general political culture being more up in arms about it? Because you look back, you know, like the LAPD in the 1950s wasn't exactly a bunch of Boy Scouts, or we look at the way that cops treated marchers during the civil rights movement. Like, it seems like cops have always been pretty violent.
Yeah, I do think there's a tendency to pine for kind of a heyday or salad days of policing that probably never existed. I will say, though, that I do think that the militarization trend is something unique. It is, even during the kind of the civil rights protest, even throughout kind of labor uprisings and other civil unrest, in the United States, we've always had this firm line between policing and the military. We keep them very separate. And, you know, even at the height of the drug war in the 1980s, there was a time when Congress and the Reagan administration wanted to kind of erase that line. They wanted the military to be coming in, doing drug raids, you know, Marines marching up and down city streets. And to its credit, to the credit of the health of our democracy, I think, it was the Pentagon that objected loudest and actually derailed those plans. But, you know, if the premise behind that is that policing and soldiering are two very different jobs and it's dangerous for a free society to conflate the two, you know, I would argue that there isn't much difference between using actual soldiers to conduct domestic policing and taking domestic police and training them like soldiers, arming them like soldiers, giving them kind of a soldier's mindset or mentality, and then telling them they're fighting a war of various kinds, whether it's a war on terror, or war on drugs, war on crime. You start to erase that distinction, not by having soldiers do the policing, but by turning your police into soldiers. And I think that's really where it's not that police brutality didn't exist. It's not that racism in policing didn't exist before all this. It's just that I think this is a particularly unique trend and one that kind of drives a lot of the other problematic trends in policing.
Can you give a sense of the scope of the problem in terms of growth? Because as Aaron mentioned, you know, there have been times in the past where some things police did, like say the old third degree, were worse than presumably what they do now. But when we're talking about, let's say, just SWAT raids, what have been the changes in terms of how many of those are being conducted versus in the earlier days of SWAT teams?
Yeah, so it's hard to put a definitive count on how many sort of SWAT deployments or SWAT raids there are each year, each day in the U.S. Peter Kraska, the criminologist I mentioned, sent surveys out to police departments across the country in the 1990s and asked them to go back to when they started their SWAT team, how many times they deployed their SWAT team. And, you know, that data is only as good as the number of police agencies that cooperated and sent the surveys back. But among those that did, you know, he estimated, I believe it was like in the late 1970s, there were a few hundred SWAT deployments per year in the U.S. And the vast majority of those were for active shooters or hostage takings or bank robberies, you know, a situation where you have somebody who is in the process of committing a violent crime. By the late 1990s, I believe it was up to 40 or 50,000 SWAT deployments per year. So from a few hundred to, you know, tens of thousands, 40 or 50,000. And about 80 to 85% of those were to serve warrants on people who were still suspected of nonviolent consensual drug offenses, typically pretty low-level offenses. So you've got this police action that, you know, in the 70s was reserved for these situations where somebody was in the process of committing a violent crime. Now it's, you know, not only is this tactic used, you know, exponentially more often, it's primarily used not to apprehend somebody who's in the process of committing a violent crime, but to serve a search warrant, to investigate somebody who's still merely suspected of a nonviolent consensual drug crime. And the problem with that is that, you know, these tactics are extraordinarily violent. There's a very thin margin for error. The police make a mistake. If somebody in the home makes a mistake, there's a good chance that somebody's going to die or end up, you know, severely injured. And yet you're using these tactics against people who haven't yet been convicted of any crime or even charged for that matter. And that really, I think, is a massive shift in how the government has used this kind of force and violence. And it's not the sort of policy where there was ever really much public debate. It's not like Congress passed, you know, a bill that militarized the police and authorized mass SWAT raids. It's something that's been gradual and that's been building up for a generation or more.
Is this stuff necessary to protect officer safety or the public safety, though? For example, I mean, you mentioned nonviolent drug offenders or people who haven't been convicted of drug offenses yet, but like I've seen enough movies from the 1980s to know that drug dealers carry a lot of firepower. And so it would seem like you send a beat cop with his revolver in there and, you know, it may not turn out well for him. So maybe this force is helpful.
So there are a couple of ways to address that. First, you know, the vast majority of police officer killings, where a police officer is, you know, feloniously killed on the job, are killed with small caliber handguns, right? So the idea that most police officers are killed with these massive guns or the massive firepower that you saw in Miami Vice, for example, just isn't borne out by the data. The other thing is, I would argue that these types of raids actually make things more dangerous for police officers. I mean, when you wake somebody up in their own home, in their own bed, in the middle of the night, with armed, you know, men breaking into their home, usually masked and dressed all in black, you elicit a very visceral kind of primitive response in people, a fight or flight response. And if flight isn't an option, people are going to fight. And so we've had, you know, numerous examples where people, where somebody, an innocent person was raided and reached for a gun and shot and killed a cop, or was shot and killed themselves, or, you know, injured police officers, but also even drug dealers, right? I mean, I've interviewed a lot of former police chiefs for my book, people who are from an era where drug warrants weren't served this way, where they were served, just like you said, a uniformed officer came and knocked on the door. And they had no problem. And what they said is that, you know, people don't go into drug dealing to kill police officers, right? They go into drug dealing to make money. And they know that killing a police officer means you're going to be lucky to survive the next 5 or 6 seconds. And if you do, you're going to prison for the rest of your life. And if you live in a death penalty state, you're probably going to get the death penalty. So I think even in cases where the police are raiding somebody who has drugs in the home, who fires back at the police, usually they'll say they didn't know that they're police. They thought they were rival drug dealers. And I think that makes a lot of intuitive sense. But there are options, you know, other than just either coming in guns blazing in the middle of the night or sending a single uniformed officer. There's a process called surround and call out, where you bring a lot of officers and you bring your bulletproof truck and you surround a place and you get on a megaphone and you ask the person to come out. Or you apprehend them as they're coming or going, or you set up some sort of ruse where you're able to apprehend them. And this is actually what police tend to do when they have suspects who are actually violent, or people who they are actually fearful, you know, will open fire on police officers. They take the time to take these extra measures, these extra protective measures. The problem with doing surround and call out or some sort of ruse when it comes to searching drug warrants, and I've had police officials flat out admit this to me, is that there's just too damn many of them. If you're a police department that's serving 15 or 20 drug warrants a week, you don't have time to do surround and call out. It's a lot easier to just kick somebody's door down in the middle of the night.
How much did alcohol prohibition change policing in this country? Because you kind of alluded to this, and it's something I've written about at Cato, that when you start prohibiting, you have, start having victimless crimes, because usually when someone commits a crime, or when someone has a crime committed against them, like you have your house robbed or you get assaulted, you call the police and you ask them to come to your house and to take evidence in order to find the perpetrator of this crime. But if you are both the criminal and the victim, like the purported criminal and the victim, because you put a substance into your body, now the police have to do something very different in order to find the criminal, so to speak, because you're not asking them to come in and give evidence up. So then they have to start adopting tactics that are very different than standard, you know, interpersonal crime when they're victims. They have to start surveilling and investigating and doing, you know, pumping your stomach and kicking down doors because you might get rid of the evidence and things like this. It seems to me that might have all kind of started during alcohol prohibition.
I mean, there are definitely similarities. I mean, I think we saw kind of a ramping up of police power during alcohol prohibition, then it kind of evolving back down when it was repealed, and then it gets fired back up for the drug war. But I think the similarities are inescapable, right? I mean, first of all, you're fighting this war based on dirty information, right? So because you don't have direct victims to report these crimes, you're relying on informants, you're relying on tips from rival drug dealers, you're relying on anonymous phone calls. And if the police don't do their due diligence and do their corroborative investigation, a lot of times you're going to have people accused who are innocent. And when the consequence of that, of having an innocent person being accused based on bad information, is that the police kick down your door in the middle of the night and put a gun in your face, those are pretty serious consequences. And those are, you know, pretty, they're consequences that can have pretty drastic implications for the people on the receiving end of these raids. The other thing, though, is when you have laws that can only be enforced by the police themselves breaking those laws, which is the case, I think, with alcohol prohibition, drug prohibition, and most consensual crimes. You instill in the police officers who work that beat or who are on that beat a sense that kind of the law doesn't matter, right? If they're allowed to break the law in order to catch drug dealers, if they're allowed to instruct informants to break the law in order to catch drug dealers, that is a whole different kind of policing than somebody who's going out on a beat and enforcing the laws, you know, as they see them broken. And I've had, I spoke to Sue Rare, who's with the Police Executive Research Forum now, but used to be the sheriff in King County, Washington, Seattle. And she made a great point, which is that she would never let her police officers be in narcotics for more than 3 or 4 years. And the reason was that being in narcotics for a long period of time changes the way you look at the job. It changes the way you look at policing. It changes the way you look at yourself. When you are allowed to break the same laws you're enforcing, it creates kind of a sense of that you're above the law, that you could also maybe break other laws as long as you have good reason or as long as the ends justifies the means. So I think both of those things, I think the fact that you have to fight these wars based on dirty information and the fact that the police have to break the very laws that they're enforcing, is just one of many ways. I think these are two of many ways that the drug war really kind of corrupts law enforcement from the top down.
How much of the problem now then is a result of, I guess, internal incentives? Like, it's easier to use these kind of tactics than less dangerous or less violent alternatives, or it's cheaper for budgetary reasons or whatever, versus cultural, in the sense that if the cops have a bunch of military equipment and are able to use it, they're attracting potentially the kind of people who want to bust heads and drive around in tanks.
Right. It's both. I mean, it's definitely both. I think that there are really perverse incentives. So, for example, there are federal grants that are tied solely to drug policing and are based on just sheer numbers of arrests, which encourages, you know, police to go out and sort of, you know, crack as many heads as possible. There's asset forfeiture policies. You know, SWAT teams are, once you get all that equipment and it's all free from the Pentagon or from DHS or whomever, but then once you have it, you have to maintain it. And that can get a little bit expensive. And so now there's an incentive to use your SWAT team for drug enforcement, because drug enforcement brings the possibility of asset forfeiture, whereas most other types, you know, you're walking a beat or, you know, responding to domestic calls, whatever, you know, all the other sort of day-to-day mundanities of policing don't generally come with that possibility. But then, you know, again, once you have that stuff, you want to use it. There are two sides, I think, to police militarization. One is the gear, the stuff that they're getting from the military, from DHS, from other places. And then there's the mindset problem. And that's, you know, police sort of seeing themselves as troops, as soldiers, seeing themselves as psychologically kind of isolated from the rest of the community. The idea that, you know, there's police and there's everybody else, or there's police and their families and there's everybody else. And these two things reinforce one another, right? You get the gear, and the gear is inappropriate for domestic police work, but then you have it, you start to see yourself as a little bit of a soldier. Maybe the community that you're supposed to be serving starts to see you less as an officer who's there to help them and more as kind of an occupying force. You're going to start to see people in the community not as the people you're serving, as citizens with rights, but as a potential threat. And so you see this throughout kind of policing culture today. If you go on online bulletin boards, if you go to sites like lawofficer.com or policing.com, you'll see this kind of mentality, whatever I have to do to get home at night, or this idea that police are constantly under attack. And, you know, generally speaking, policing has gotten safer since about the early 1990s. There are some, you know, jumps and dips in the number of police officers feloniously killed each year, but for the most part, it's been trending down for about 30 years now. You know, the idea that every police officer kind of has a target on their back and that they need to be constantly vigilant and that everybody is a potential threat and every interaction could be their last, not only is it not true, not backed up by the data, but it really creates a lot of tension and animosity between police and the community they serve. But it's also just, it's kind of a miserable existence for a police officer, right? I mean, if you know, you don't have any kind of relationships on your job with people who aren't police officers, if all your interactions with non-cops on your job are hostile, that's kind of a miserable work experience. It also just puts people on edge. I mean, you know, if you're told that everybody's a potential threat, if you're told that there's a target on your back, you're going to be more likely to see an innocent gesture as a furtive one, right? You're going to be more likely to kind of rule, your actions are going to be ruled more by your kind of limbic system than your frontal lobe. And I think that's a problem as well.
How does, I mean, when we're talking about criminal justice and maybe especially policing, we can't not discuss race issues. And it's interesting because something I've written about too, we use the rhetoric of war, war on drugs, war on crime. And one of the interesting things about war in the more, the real sense of the word war, the international kind of foreign conflict problem, is that dehumanizing the opponent is kind of essential to fighting a war. I mean, unless you need your soldiers to think that they are, you know, they're not Germans, they're Huns, you know, and have your cartoons and all this stuff, because otherwise you're just murdering people. I feel like that's similar to what you have to do here, and race plays a big factor in that when it comes to making war on our own citizens.
Yep. No, absolutely. I mean, you see the dehumanization in rhetoric, drug war rhetoric, going back to the Nixon administration, you know, referring to people as vermin or cockroaches or you know, just kind of denying people their basic humanity. And you know, there's been a push in the drug law reform movement for a long time toward treating addiction as a health issue instead of a criminal issue. And, you know, the problem with that, if you're a drug warrior, is if you start to see people with drug problems as people with a health problem and not as people who are breaking the law, it becomes a lot more difficult to dehumanize them. And I think that's one reason why you've seen, you know, there was long such resistance on the kind of law and order right to acknowledging that drug addiction is a health issue and not some sort of moral or human failing. But I think that, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And as far as, you know, race goes, going back to 19 teens and 20s and 30s, you know, the drug war, alcohol prohibition, all these kind of wars on substances have always been about othering, you know, a certain ethnic group, and the drug war certainly, you know, the modern drug war, I think, is certainly a continuation of that.
What role do judges play in all this? Because they presumably are not subject to the same incentives or part of the same culture as the police officers, and they have to approve these warrants before the SWAT team can bust in, right?
They do. I think there are two ways that the courts have contributed to the problem. One is, I think, the appellate courts, from the Supreme Court to the federal appeals courts to state Supreme Courts, have really contributed to the problem by creating this drug war exception to the Fourth Amendment. And that's been happening for, you know, going back to the late 50s, basically, if not further. The drug war has, you know, I talk in the book a lot about the castle doctrine and this idea that the home should be a place of peace and sanctuary. And this is where the knock and announce requirement comes from. And the courts have basically obliterated the knock and announce requirement. It still kind of technically exists in name, but there's no consequence when police violate it, even egregiously. The Supreme Court has ruled that the exclusionary rule won't apply when police violate the knock and announce rule. There's rarely, if ever, any discipline for police officers when they violate the rule. And, you know, with qualified immunity, it's extremely difficult to win a lawsuit. There's just a case a couple weeks ago where a police officer or a SWAT team raided this elderly man. And the SWAT team actually knew that they were raiding the wrong house because they got to the house and the address didn't match. And they just sort of assumed that maybe the error was on the other end, not on their end, and they raided the house anyway. And the federal courts ruled that they had qualified immunity because they couldn't find another case in which a court had explicitly said that raiding the wrong house intentionally is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So that's kind of the role I think that the Supreme Court and the appellate courts have played. But then just day to day, judges have really abrogated their constitutional duty to protect the Fourth Amendment. I would love to see a study on what percentage of search warrants are approved versus denied, what percentage of particularly no-knock search warrants are approved versus denied. There isn't a recent study that's kind of directly on point. There are some studies from the 80s and early 90s, though, that show that judges almost never reject search warrants. They reject specifically no-knock warrants maybe a tiny bit more often, but there's almost no scrutiny. There have been studies showing that judges have granted no-knock warrants even when police didn't request them. And I've my own reporting over the last several years has found lots of examples of this. In Little Rock, Arkansas, I reviewed about 100 warrants that were conducted over about a 2.5 year period, all no knocks. And in every case, the warrant itself was illegal. The police had, under Supreme Court precedent, the police have to, if they want to conduct a no knock raid, they have to provide specific information as to why this particular suspect poses a risk to police if they knock and announce. You can't just use boilerplate language, saying all drug dealers are dangerous, therefore we have to use a no-knock. But that's exactly what the Little Rock Police Department was doing. They just used the same word-for-word language in every single warrant and requested a no-knock every single time. And with the exception of maybe one or two cases, the judges signed the warrant every single time. And the reason why they get away with that is, it is a clear, egregious, no debate about it, violation of Supreme Court's ruling in this case, Richards versus Wisconsin, which says that you can't just use this kind of boilerplate language. And yet nothing happened. One of the judges who signed about half the warrants now has a higher judicial office. The other is retired. The police officers who sought the illegal warrants, nothing has happened to any of them. And the reason for that is because, again, the Supreme Court created this rule in 1997, but then in 2006 with Hudson versus Michigan, they basically said, okay, we have this rule. The police have to knock and announce before they come in, but we're not going to give them any, or there's no reason, we're not going to enforce it. There's not going to be any penalty if they violate the rule. And so the police have since basically violated the rule with impunity. Judges don't even bother sort of enforcing it anymore. And it's not just Little Rock. I mean, we saw similar examples in Louisville after the Breonna Taylor, the death of Breonna Taylor. I've written about similar examples in South Carolina. And I bet if somebody, paid the money to do a kind of comprehensive look across the country at how these warrants are applied for and granted by judges, we would find it's very similar. My guess is that we find a very, very tiny percentage of judges ever deny police a search warrant. Those that do, the police know not to go to those judges anymore, so they can seek out judges that are less, provide less scrutiny. But also that I think we would see that a lot of these warrants are illegal and nothing's being done about it.
We hear about these botched raids quite often, and it's sort of stunning. I mean, I don't think the police are usually doing botched SWAT raids, and of course the ones that get reported are not maybe representative of the whole, but it seems to happen a disturbingly large number of times in ways that are sort of just gratuitously erroneous. Like, you could have just looked up the address, as you pointed out. Is this just because the police, do you think this is directly tied to the fact that they don't really care? I mean, they're viewing everyone as subhuman and there's no consequences, and maybe they're not even worried about the safety of their fellow officers because they're dressed like soldiers, so they just don't really care about making mistakes?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think they don't feel like it's dangerous to them because they're on the giving end of this, right? They know what's going to happen. They have the advantage. They're taking the other people by surprise. And look, I mean, if there are candid interviews with the SWAT officers, there's a great one in the documentary Do Not Resist, where they go to one of these SWAT meetups, these kind of SWAT competitions, and they talk to some officers, and they flat out admit that it's a huge rush to go on one of these raids, right? It's you get a lot of adrenaline going, and it's apparently a lot of fun for them. I'm speaking very broadly and very generally here, but I do think that there's a kind of disregard for the rights of the people who are on the receiving end of this of these raids because they're drug users, they're morally weak, they're criminals basically, and I think that's the way that the police look at it. But I also think there's all of that, but then also there are no consequences for getting it wrong, right? The courts have basically ruled that if the police raid a wrong house because they made a mistake, as long as you can't prove that the mistake was intentional, which is pretty much impossible, and in most cases probably isn't the case. It's just a lack of diligence and you know, doing your corroborative investigation. But unless you can show it's intentional, you're not, you know, nothing's going to happen to them. And, you know, for the level of violence that comes with one of these raids, the fact that there are no consequences for mistakenly kind of visiting that violence on the wrong person, you know, ought to trouble us, to say the least.
How much of all of this is the result of racism, or at least racially motivated? Because if we listen to the, you know, we've had the protests over the last year and a lot of conversation about criminal justice reform, and a lot of it has focused on racism within policing and criminal justice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's always difficult to kind of isolate how much race is a motivating factor, right? We know that that the drug war was waged with kind of racist intent and racist justifications and racist stereotypes of various groups that that aren't true. We also know that that continues to be the case, right? There are multiple studies. I mean, the data on this is overwhelming, in multiple cities showing that while Black people are much more likely to be searched when they're pulled over, they are less likely to actually be carrying contraband. So the police are more suspicious of Black people than white people, even though you know, white people who are pulled over, at least, are more likely to have some sort of illegal substance on them. And, you know, we see the arrest rates compared to usage rates, and all of it, you know, strongly points to a drug war that is disproportionately directed at non-white people and Black people in particular. It's always difficult to you know, delve into the motivations of individual police officers or individual, you know, an individual SWAT team. But we know that, you know, in policing in general, that there is a problem with race. We know over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen multiple reports about where investigators have looked into social media posts by police officers. And we see a disturbingly high percentage of officers have posted, you know, put racist stuff on Facebook or Twitter or other online forums, or have, you know, sort of glorified police violence, anti-Muslim posts. And, you know, we also see just kind of a glorification of violence in police culture in general. I've written a lot about police t-shirts, for example, that you see like during police week in Washington, D.C., or that police unions sell. And they're, you know, awful. They glamorize violence. They dehumanize people. A lot of times they're explicitly racist. So, you know, obviously I'm not saying all police officers are racist. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there is a race problem within policing. I think there's institutional racism in policing, which is that we have a system that was kind of designed and honed during a period in our country's history where there were explicitly racist policies, right? Jim Crow, for example. A lot of those institutions are still with us. I think it's a mistake to think that we somehow purged all of the kind of racist intent from those institutions just because, you know, Jim Crow ended, you know, whenever it ended officially, I don't know, late 60s maybe. But then, you know, so there's that. And institutional racism, I think, is going to exist independent of the motivations of individual police officers. But then I also think that we have seen, you know, through some of these reports, that there are a lot of problems with bias and racism with individual officers as well. At the Post, I've got an ongoing kind of piece where I just have been accumulating academic literature on race in the criminal justice system. And, you know, the numbers are pretty overwhelming, even when you account for crime rates, you know, between Black and the Black and white populations. Black people are clearly over-policed. I'm rambling a little bit.
I think that's part of the story. The story you tell, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I agree with you, but you also made a good point that I use an example from your last book, Cadaver King and Country Dentist, where there are things that can start for racist purposes. As you point out in that book, Mississippi lacked a credible death investigation system for most of the 20th century because they were using it to exonerate lynchings. But by the time you got to the 80s, there was a different group there were different interest groups that had formed around what was originally a racist policy. And this happens a lot in right? So you might have started the drug war because you didn't like Mexicans very much, let's say prohibition of marijuana. But then by the time you're trying to get rid of it in California in 2009 or 10, when the first time, it's the prison guard unions that want to keep marijuana prohibition. And they may not be racist at all. They just want a job. And it was the prosecutors and the AGs, you know, in Mississippi who didn't want to have a credible death investigation system. There's a lot of these around here. Like the cops like their gear. They like the way they do their job. Maybe they enjoy cracking heads, and some of them are racist. But then there are other groups around them, like police officers unions, that are just protecting what they think are the interests of police officers. So I think it's important to point out that this stuff is actually intermixed with so many different interest groups, that including just out and out racists, but then things that are sort of racially institutionalized, but maybe not performed by out and out racists.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, I particularly over the last couple of years, I've, you know, got into debates and discussions with libertarians on this issue. And it kind of baffles me why libertarians and even conservatives to a certain extent have such a difficult time admitting that something is racist. It doesn't hurt me to admit that the criminal justice system is racist as a white person, right? There's no skin off my back on that. But there is this extreme reluctance. And, you know, as a libertarian especially, you know, the idea of racist policing or racially, you know, disproportionate policing or the over-policing of Black people, what that means is that it means that there are a lot of people in this country who are going to be unfairly accused, unfairly arrested, unfairly searched, unfairly targeted because they belong to a group that is assumed, probably truthfully, to commit more crimes, right? So you're treating people, you're using government force and coercion against someone, not because of something they did, but because they belong to a group who you think commits more crimes. And you know, as a libertarian, that ought to offend the hell out of us, right? The government should be judging us and accusing us based on what we actually did, not based on what people who look like us did. And I don't think there's anything, you know, unlibertarian about recognizing that this happens in government and being opposed to it and working to stop it.
Related to that, though, is there a concern that a too much of a focus on race as the driver of so many of these things might get in the way of meaningful reform, because it would get people thinking, if we can just get rid of the racism, everything will be good? Or has them overlooking problems that don't tie into that particular kind of sub-narrative of criminal justice?
You know, I understand that argument, and you know, I think maybe there is some merit to it to some extent. I will say, though, that, you know, Black Lives Matter has been more successful than, you know, those of us who have been beating this drum for 20 years at actually getting real police reform implemented. And, you know, they've done that through the lens of kind of racial justice, right? But white people benefit from these police reforms as well. I mean, if you go to like the Campaign Zero webpage and you look at their recommendations for police reform, that's all driven from a kind of racial justice viewpoint, but you know, white people will benefit if police initiate those policies, if we abolish qualified immunity, if, you know, so I'm hesitant to say that putting that viewing a lot of the problems of the criminal justice system through race is going to hamper reform. I think there's good evidence that it has actually helped reform. Now, that said, you know, white people are victims of police abuse and police misconduct. It happens all the time. And, you know, I think it's wrong to pretend otherwise. I think that there are problems in policing and the criminal justice system that are racially motivated. I think there are problems that have nothing to do with race and are more about sort of power and control. But I also think that even those problems are exacerbated by race and the country's history with race. But, you know, I'll give you a good example sort of from the book. So when the book first came out, it, you know, got very positive reviews. But the one criticism I kept seeing over and over again from some quarters is that the book was, the examples that I used in the book were primarily white people accused of basically marijuana-related crimes. And in my original manuscript, which is about twice as long as the book, I had a lot more of examples, and some examples that did include Black people. They got cut for various reasons, mostly because when we were editing and trying to cut the manuscript down, we chose cases that best kind of illustrated a particular point that the book was trying to make. But in doing so, we cut out a lot of the examples of Black people. And so I think it is a valid criticism that the book, that the anecdotes in the book to kind of illustrate points portray a picture of who's victimized by the drug war that probably isn't entirely accurate. And I tried to remedy that a little bit in this update. But there's a reason for that. The reason why the cases involving white people were more apt to illustrate a particular point is because those are the cases where the victim had a platform because they were white in large part, but they were able to get a lawyer to take their case, or they were able to get a journalist to look into the case, or they got a lawyer and the resulting lawsuit flushed out facts about the case that, you know, were probably hidden in a lot of these raids on Black people, because Black people, when you're a Black person and you're subject to one of these raids, it's hard, you know, to get people interested, much less, you know, believe that you're innocent. And so what we find are that the cases where police have victimized white people in these cases tend to be the ones that kind of blow everything up, that expose, you know, the fundamental problems in the system and the repeat problems, the incentive issues. It tends to be white people or very sympathetic Black people, like the 92-year-old woman, Katherine Johnston, who was killed in a police raid in Atlanta in 2006. Those are the cases that, you know, get public sympathy, that get investigations going, that get reforms. But when you look back at that, since those are the cases that get all the attention, you know, if you're not following the stuff closely, you could be, you know, forgiven for thinking that most of these raids target white people, because those are the cases that you tend to read about.
I completely agree about libertarians, and it's sort of odd how some libertarians or people who call themselves libertarians resist these kind of racially tinged language. Whereas, I mean, in addition to your points, you know, if we understand that the power of the state can be wielded by the people who win elections, the people who create the interest groups, and then they can use the power of the state to pursue their interests that are against the interests of the people who lost the election. Well, we also then understand that if a bunch of those people are racist, then they're using the power of the state to pursue their racist policies against another race. And so a lot of, as you know, write in the book, like the Watts riots were a huge, you know, signpost on this story of a bunch of people being, you know, white people being very, very afraid. And that's when we get the first SWAT team and we start seeing a lot of the policing in Black neighborhoods, or at least maybe the quote unquote demand for the drug war, coming from white people, and the cost of that being put onto Black people, which is something we shouldn't be for when it comes to the state's obligation to treat people the same, as you pointed out.
It's a recurring story too, right? So in the update to the book, One of the cities I look at is Chicago in some detail, because Chicago never really kind of experienced the drop in violent crime that the rest of the country did. And, you know, people have always assumed that the reason for that is gang culture, or, you know, Black culture, Black on Black crime, whatever you want to call it. But you know, Chicago also has a long history of police abuse and misconduct, going back to the John Burge, you know, torture scandal of the 1980s, which, frankly, you know, was only recently resolved. I mean, they only established reparations for the victims in, I think it was 2013 or 2014. But then you have, you know, Laquan McDonald, you've got the Chicago Police Union, you've got multiple examples of police oversight boards in Chicago that have been captured by the police unions that they're supposed to be overseeing. You've got, you know, multiple incidents of officers, you know, lying. You've got a small percentage of officers with an overwhelming number of complaints against them who are never disciplined. And the amazing thing is, when I was researching for the update to the book, I found this report from a Blue Ribbon Commission that had been put together in the 1970s after the police killed a Black motorist after pulling him over. I think it was for some sort of traffic violation. There was a lot of outrage about it, and there was this commission that was formed. The commission wrote a report that talked about, you know, the problems with policing in Chicago. Well, after the Laquan McDonald shooting, actually not after the shooting, about a year later, after the city was forced to release the video and then forced to admit that the shooting was unjustified, there was another commission that was formed to write another report about Chicago policing. And the Chicago Reader compared the two reports, which were about 40 years apart, And the conclusions that they came to were remarkably similar. I mean, they talk about there's no accountability, how the officers in charge of investigating other officers tend to, you know, prod them to give the right answers. They let them collaborate their stories. They talk about Black people being afraid of being pulled over by officers. They talk about how Black complaints against white officers are, you know, not even investigated. And it was just kind of stunning. I mean, in some cases, the language was, you know, almost verbatim outlining the problems. And these two reports were 40 years apart and almost nothing had changed.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of goes to some of how we kind of fix this stuff, too, because I mean, the racism is a problem and how this, but we have the militarization, which you know, is again used on white people quite often too, these SWAT raids. And I've had calls and consultations with Black Lives Matter people and Campaign Zero people about what to do. And one of the things that I've told them is that, you know, although they have been successful, you know, more than if anyone else in the last 20 years, but is that sometimes you just need to take away their toys, you know, giving them implicit bias training or something like this, which is the kind of thing that the police union would try and make a concession on, that they'll have training to take away their racist bias. Whereas, I mean, I'm scared of something like that because it's an empty solution that doesn't actually do anything. Whereas I just want to take away their toys. I mean, I think if they have tanks, they will use them. And due to all these factors we've discussed, they will use them disproportionately on African Americans. So I'm, you know, much more pragmatic in the sense of I can't rewrite the cops' minds to be less racist, but we can take away their toys as a start.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, I mean, we're never going to have an unarmed police force, right? I mean, they're always going to have guns.
Oh, I mean, like the tanks. Yeah, I mean, like the ones that they use. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, the implicit bias stuff, I've seen the studies that doesn't work. I've also talked to Black police officers who have attended those classes and say they don't work because they're not designed to work, right? They're designed to sort of check off boxes so that the police department can then say, you know, yes, we gave everybody implicit bias training. There's not, the effort isn't really there to actually, you know, make officers aware of their own bias and teach them how to kind of think their way out of it. It's just, we're just going to let everybody sit through this class so that we can tell the federal government that we did it. But, you know, I don't know that it works or it doesn't work. I do think, you know, I think I'm much more interested in tangible kind of substantive reforms like, you know, like you said, taking some of the gear work, but also just things like we just need to remove the opportunity for these bad incidents to happen, right? So getting police out of traffic enforcement, for example, so you don't have the situation where you have an armed officer confronting you over a very, very minor offense in a very kind of fraught and difficult encounter, right? He's on the side of the road, cars are whizzing by, cops are sort of have it hammered into their heads from the police academy that, like, you know, every stop, on any traffic stop, somebody could, you know, ambush you and pull out a gun and blow you away, which, you know, it happens 3 or 4 times a year out of, I don't know how many million stops, but enough that, you know, there are lots of videos to circulate. So you have this incredibly tense kind of situation where you've got a cop who's, you know, sees every stop as a potential shootout. You've got motorists, particularly Black and brown motorists, who don't trust the police, who are worried about getting searched, who are worried about, you know, things escalating. There's no reason why the police should be doing that. You know, it can be done with, as a libertarian, it pains me to say this, but I think it's the better option of the two. It can be done with traffic cameras. We could also engineer and design our roads better so that we don't need as many rules, right? You know, roundabouts instead of stop signs, that kind of thing. We could also just enforce traffic laws less. you know, speed limits are pretty artificial for the most part. They're not the result of some study to find the optimal safe speed in that particular zone. It's basically, in a lot of cases, they're artificially low in order to generate revenue for the local government. So we can get police out of that altogether. We can get police out of the schools. There's no data showing that police school resource officers actually make schools safer. We can start funding violence interruption groups. And here's another area where I think, you know, libertarians, we could not even change the way we think about it, but just kind of be open to this idea. I've written about these groups like Cure Violence. They, you know, what they do is they try to intervene before the violence and the kind of retaliatory violence starts escalating. And a lot of times they'll hire kind of former gang members or people, you know, from the neighborhoods where violence is happening. And study after study after study has shown that they're effective at reducing violence and reducing homicides in particular, both sort of chronologically. So when they're well funded, violence tends to go down, but also geographically, the neighborhoods where they operate tend to have lower violent crime figures after they start operating there. And yeah, as a libertarian, if I can spend, you know, the amount of money I'd have to pay for salary and benefits for 10 police officers, and I can hire 100 of these violence interrupters and get the same reduction in violent crime or even a better reduction, the reduction is achieved in a way that it uses less force and coercion, and there's less opportunity for escalation and, you know, violence and tragedy. Why wouldn't we go for that option? You know, I mean, it seems to work. There's also CAHOOTS program out of Eugene that's spreading across the country, where when somebody is having a mental health crisis and they call 911, instead of sending a SWAT team, which is, to me, has always been the most absurd possible way you can react to that kind of situation, they send a paramedic and a counselor. And that's been enormously effective everywhere that it's been tried.
Over the last few years, and particularly over the last year, we've seen a wave of progressive and reform prosecutors elected, a sustained criminal justice reform movement, and even what looks like a possible winding down of the drug war. Are these lasting and meaningful changes, or at least do you think maybe we're on the cusp of getting lasting and meaningful changes?
I think some of them will be. I hope some of them will be. I mean, I've never seen the kind of substantive reforms that we've seen since the protests last year. You know, in the almost 20 years or so I've been covering police militarizations and these raids, I've never before this year, never in any state or any city have I seen a serious proposal to end or limit no-knock raids. There have been a few sort of individual police chiefs who implemented policies to cut down on them, but since Breonna Taylor, since the George Floyd protests, literally dozens of cities across the country have banned no-knock raids, and in a couple states. And these are, you know, some of them are problematic. Some of them have loopholes that are way too big for my taste. Some of them have a problem with a lack of enforcement mechanism. Some of them are very good. The Virginia law ban on no-knocks, I think, is great. I think it's the only thing I would add is it needs a provision, you know, requiring officers to be wearing body cameras when they conduct these raids. But I've never seen that kind of legislative action, you know, that we've seen over the last year. Also, you know, similar legislation on chokeholds, on de-escalation training, you know, across the board. We've seen a lot of really strong substance reforms at the state and local level, nothing at the federal level, of course. But by the same token, we've seen lots of state legislatures pass these bills that, you know, limit the liability of people who run over protesters with their cars. And with the result of the surge in homicides we've seen over the last year, I think, you know, there's going to be some backlash. We're going to see probably some progressive prosecutors get beaten. We're probably going to see some reforms get rolled back in, you know, particularly conservative states. You know, I don't know. You know, I'm hoping, my hope is that the homicide surge is related to the pandemic and the, you know, once in a lifetime weird phenomenon, aberrant phenomenon that was 2020, and that we're going to see things start to go back to normal. But I don't know. You know, the bad policies that we got that resulted in mass incarceration, that resulted in the evisceration of the Fourth Amendment, that resulted in, you know, a lot of the problems we have the criminal justice system today were the result of policies that were passed in response to soaring crime rates. And hopefully we've learned from that, and hopefully we'll be kind of more nuanced and careful and less reactionary in how we respond to this latest homicide surge. But I don't know. As a politician, it's, you know, much, much easier to support, you know, getting tough on crime policies because, like Bastiat argued with economic policies, I think the cost of those policies tend to be hidden. Whereas it's very easy to, you know, tie a a rise in murder to a more progressive DA's office, you know, despite the fact that spike in homicides has happened, you know, all over the country, including in cities that have pretty conservative prosecutors.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.